Welcome to MoneyWeb Now. Business news every morning.
It's Monday, 6 January. Happy New Year. We've got UK new cars sales data due later this morning. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you loud and still recorded from my studio in Rosebank. Programming note, this whole week we're going to have single interviews for the show because it is a quiet week on the market and nothing much is happening. Today, Chantal Marks, Head of Research, F&B Wealth and Investments. I want to talk around those big themes from 2024, interest rates, inflation, elections, AI and the rest. And then which of those should we keep an eye on for 2025? This podcast is brought to you by StanLib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Chantal Marks, Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments. Chantal, always appreciate the time. 2024, if we look at the investment landscape, I mean, it was wild. We had more elections than I think ever before. We had incumbents losing left, right, and center. We've got AI going rampant. We've got all sorts of economic issues, but markets just liked it.
Absolutely. And I think that you hit the nail on the head with the AI story, because that's really what drove markets, particularly equity markets, developed equity markets in the US in particular. Because in the absence of that, markets would have been meh, I think. But we did see the Mag 7. We saw NVIDIA up almost 200% for the year. And this is a function of a lot of excitement about new technological developments that can improve efficiency and can give us some progress in terms of economic growth going forward.
Yeah, and I'm old enough to remember the last time this happened, which was the dot-com boom of 2000. We all know how that ended. This is different in some ways, but in some ways not, because the person or the company making all the money here is still NVIDIA. I mean, Meta is spending, Microsoft is spending, Alphabet is spending, but they're not yet making much from AI.
Yes, so they are not making much from AI yet, but they have very successful businesses outside of the capex that they're spending on AI that is actually funding those investments. If you think about the dot-com bubble, a lot of it was hot air, where what we have right now is a lot of spending on something that could be great, could not pan out, but in either event, these companies have rock-solid balance sheets and they will be fine. I think the question mark is just not whether or not these companies will collapse, but whether or not they'll still demand those premium valuation ratings that we've gotten used to, and whether or not they'll continue to trade at PEs of upwards of 35 times. It looks a little bit stretched, but it's not as scary as the dot-com bubble yet.
Yeah, Pets.com, whose business model was to sell pet food below cost, and no one understood it, including Pets.com, although they made a fortune by selling the domain out of bankruptcy. You're right around those big Mag 7. They are making plenty of money, and I suppose they can't say, no, we'll wait. I mean, I remember Meta and Mark Zuckerberg going all in on the metaverse. You've got to be playing. It's table stakes to have yourself some AI and not get left behind.
Yes, and I think that it's important to make those investments because you don't want to be left behind. And it's also important to be in a position, cash flow-wise, to make a mistake if you do make one. I mean, Meta is actually a really great example that you brought up, because they did go all in on the metaverse. No one's buying those glasses. Well, apparently, they're the market leader in those VR glasses, but no one I know is buying them. But they've admitted that they may have gone in a little bit too hard. They've pulled back that spending. That stock has recovered. Cash flows are covering the costs. I think it's less risky than it would have been in the dot-com era. My only thing is, these are like the big ones, right? So these are the Mag 7 stocks. But I'm thinking there are so many stocks that we don't know anything about, whose names we've never heard, down here at the southern tip of Africa. And perhaps it's worth actually exploring whether there are some hot air AI stocks in the US that can potentially lead to a bit of a volatility spike somewhere in 2025.
I take your point. There absolutely must be, just that I think everyone and their grandfathers focusing on those Mag 7. Let's switch course. Let's touch on inflation and rates. That was the big anticipation for 2024. We did get inflation down locally very nicely. The US down, not quite a target. We've got rates coming down later than we had hoped for. I still remember the 6 rate cuts promised in the US for the year. Didn't happen, but it's moving in the right direction, and that's good for individuals. It's good for corporates. It's just good news.
Yes, so I think that will be especially supportive in the first quarter of 2025 and perhaps even going into the second quarter of 2025, because monetary policy kind of works with lags, and it's uncertain whether or not we'll get the full impact of the late 2024 cuts already in the first quarter, right? But it should start filtering through. I think the risk event, or the risk for next year surrounding interest rates, is that we won't have that leveling out of interest rates that could kind of keep things relatively loose for a while. And the main thing could be, we don't know what's going to happen from a policy perspective in the Trump administration. If some of these policies are implemented, particularly around immigration and tariffs, that could end up being inflationary. Again, it works with a lag, so it might not be immediate, but it could mean that this cutting cycle, which we expect it to be shallow, but to actually have kind of a lower, higher interest rate for longer situation, could be short-lived. And maybe we'll start thinking about when the Fed hikes again, dare I say.
I mean, dare you say, and I want to come to Trump in a moment, but I mean, the futures markets were suggesting there's a 26% chance of a US hike next year. You're one person who, over the last many, many months, has been saying, expect the cutting cycle to be shallower. And that evidence, even you know, Trump aside, Jerome Powell and his team are going to perhaps just over on the side of caution. I know they say they're data dependent, but we're not going to get significant cuts, and we're not going to get US rates anywhere near back to even they were pre-pandemic, probably not South Africa either.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect us to get there unless there's a black swan event, unless something breaks. If something breaks, the really great thing is that there is powder dry now, both in the US and in South Africa. So this shallow interest rate cutting cycle, I think, actually sets you up nicely to withstand any sort of shock, because you can cut rates. You still have a lot of room to cut to pre-pandemic levels. But unless something like that happens, I don't expect this cutting cycle to bring us anywhere near pre-pandemic levels. In South Africa, you have the added complexity of us perhaps lowering our inflation target.
Yeah.
So that supports the case for kind of less rate cuts even further.
A lower inflation target for South Africa, your view on it? My sense is it's a good idea. We just need to do it, I suppose, carefully. And if anyone can do it carefully, it's our MPC and SARB.
Yes, and importantly, the research shows that you have to do it in a cutting cycle.
Yeah.
That's when you have the least externalities or the least unwanted outcomes around it. I mean, you can't really do it in a hiking cycle. You'll absolutely destroy the consumer. You can't do it while rates are flat, because then why? Mm. So this is the right time to do it. I think long term, it's really great if inflation is lower. But I think that it could, given the state of the South African consumer, be a little bit disappointing, particularly for households.
Yeah, and a little bit painful. A last point on rates has been REITs, Real Estate Investment Trusts. They certainly locally had a very, very good year, that went cool towards the end. But globally as well, they liked lower rates. But now they've sort of got to a fair value. I mean, a phrase I'm always scared to use, but my sense is that they anticipated it, they got it, and now it's a case of, well, yes, here we are.
Yes, so I mean, they benefit from lower interest rates in a number of ways. So most of these companies carry quite a bit of leverage. Mm-hmm. So that's debt. So finance costs come down. That filters through to the bottom line. Lower interest rates stimulate economic growth. That is quite positive from a property fundamental perspective. And then these guys compete with bonds for your cash allocation. So when bond yields are low, these guys also tend to, or lower, these guys also tend to do quite well. And obviously there will be a period where you get this really nice run up and then you'll get a sort of a stabilization. And I think that we're now at that stabilization. Now, one of two things can happen. Either you have a situation where property fundamentals continue to improve because economic growth continues to improve and we don't have big interest rate hikes next year. In that case, I think the REITs can still do well. And I'd be very interested in gaining further exposure a little if this breather that we've seen now continues. But it could also go the other way. The growth outlook could fade because of some of the inflationary issues that we could see coming through next year and higher rates. So, yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one. I think you've made the easy money now. And now you have to almost be like Powell and assess the data before you continue.
Data dependent. Hey, on data dependent bonds, I mean, they all over the world, South Africa included, a really, really good year for bonds. In fact, a stellar year for bonds. At some points, they were outperforming equity. There's still a case for bonds. Even with lower inflation and even with lower rates, bonds still making a good argument to be in a portfolio.
Yes, I think particularly South African bonds still look really good if you look at the yield differentials relative to the US, for example. I think there definitely is still some room there. And in South Africa, we have a few other supporting factors. We have a fiscal stabilization that is seemingly going quite well. We have the prospect of getting off the grey list at some point next year. It's looking increasingly likely that over the next, let's call it 12 to 18 months, we could see an upgrade to our sovereign credit rating. And we're still thinking that we could start attracting fund flows into next year just on a relative basis, because I think from an emerging markets perspective, we're probably the best of a bad bunch right now. The reform agenda is taking shape. And as I mentioned, we don't look expensive on the bond market or the equity market. So all of these things could be quite positive. We still see double-digit returns from year on out for the next 12 months from the South African bond market. And it's a great diversifier because it doesn't look exactly like the equity market.
No, 100%. So let's get back to Trump. 20 Jan is his swear-in date. I think my sense of Trump is that all we can be certain of is lots of shouty tweets.
Tweets or truth socials?
Truth, yes, yes, the socials, yes. Because, I mean, he says a lot. He's threatened us. He's withdrawn the threats. It's going to be a wild time. Maybe this time, many years after his first term, we're as a market, sort of maybe a little bit smarter.
Yes, so I think we're a little less freaked out by Trump, but I mean that could be to our own peril because he will be more emboldened than he was in his first term to do what he thinks he needs to do or do what his advisors say he needs to do. I think it's going to be a really interesting 4 years from a US policy perspective. I mean, the tariff story is one thing, but that could also just be a bargaining tool. You've also got the immigration thing, but I think even he knows that they've got a labor shortage, particularly in low skill and unskilled labor. You have the geopolitics story where he's very convinced he can actually bring peace to the Middle East and in the Russia-Ukraine instance. And that, I think, could actually be quite positive. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be an interesting 4 years. Obviously, we'll get a better sense once he's elected and you actually start seeing implementation and not just rhetoric. But we'll have to take it as it comes. You cannot base your entire long-term investment view on 4 years of Donald Trump.
100%. But that does then also bring me to China, which I have to say, for me, was the disappointment of 2024. They had their elective conference last year. Xi Jinping got a third term. They cancelled their zero COVID policy and then kind of went to sleep.
Yes, I mean, I would agree. That was probably our biggest disappointment as well, because we had the reopening. It didn't go really well, and then it kind of just faded into just, I can't even explain to you just what it feels like looking at a Chinese equity market or Chinese economic data. A consumer that has so little confidence in the economy, it's just it's just incredible to see a slump to deflation take place. And you don't want a situation where China becomes the next Japan, but they are going to have to show really solid fiscal intervention. They're going to have to put money in the hands of consumers for them to feel better, to start spending and to start pushing up inflation again. You cannot have a situation where you have deflation for the next 15 years and you have the second largest economy in the world becoming the fifth.
I hadn't even thought of that. Ouch. So then what about Europe? Europe's like the kid at school who always could do better. Every year I look at Europe and I think this is your year, Europe. Of course, they've got the Ukraine war, which makes all sorts of craziness in their energy market. The equity markets in some cases have done okay. Europe, I mean, is this the year for Europe or should we just really just move on?
Yes, I mean, I'm also hoping that we will get a better year for Europe. I mean, you have some incredible companies that are innovating and based in Europe. And I think that you will start seeing an improvement in the valuations for some of those companies. I mean, we have some standouts. You've had the likes of Novo Nordisk coming out of Europe during this time, although technically it's Scandinavia.
Sure.
but you do have incredible companies that are really working hard on some of the key issues that we're facing today. So in AI, in technology, in defense, in renewable energy, I think that they are going to, they're really committed, many of these big companies and many of the bigger economies in Europe, to show some technological leadership. And I'm hoping that that gives them a bigger role and that it helps us from an equity valuation perspective as well. And perhaps just from a stabilization perspective when we look at economic growth. It's very frustrating to just look at the US and just look at China. Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if Europe starts growing again?
It absolutely would. And as you were talking, it made me think, because one of the post-pandemic has been this whole idea of onshoring. And of course, again, we look to the US, we look at the CHIPS Act and everything. But I was reading something, Germany's got an equivalent of CHIPS Act, and maybe the onshoring, because of the manufacturing sort of heart of the European economy, can actually help the European economy.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've spoken, I think, in the past about Taiwan Semiconductor, which is the biggest chip factory in the world. They actually make the chips that NVIDIA designs. And these guys had to invest in the US to kind of nearshore and make sure that they can get around some of the rules around imported goods. And they made a massive investment and built a big manufacturing facility in Arizona. But very much on the DL, they're also in the process of building a big manufacturing plant in Germany.
Yeah.
So I think that those investments will do Europe well. And I think that it's kind of flying under the radar because everything's about the US and tariffs right now, and no one's thinking about nearshoring opportunities elsewhere.
Yeah, so maybe it's up to the likes of me to go and find the European stories. Well, leave it there. Chantal Marx, Head of Research, FNB Wealth and Investments. Always appreciate the insights. The Standard Flexible Income Fund delivers capital preservation and consistent top quartile inflation-beating returns. Let your money keep working with Standard Asset Management even after you retire.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
That's it for today. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast, just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Norbuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. And Dean Kaba, founding partner and chairman, Convergence Partners.
Listen to the live stream of MoneyWeb Now at the same time every weekday. For more business, finance, and investment news. MoneyWeb Now. On the money. Also available on podcast.